Welcome back to the program. Susan Sontag, Illness as a Metaphor, said that any important disease whose causality is murky and for which treatment is ineffectual tends to be awash in significance. Often it's because that disease overwhelms us. Because in an age in which we are all focused on our health, it's often the reality of sickness that changes our world and our worldview. We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Nora Gallagher. She's the best-selling author of Things Seen and Unseen, as well as Practicing Resurrection and Changing Light. She's given lectures at Yale, Stanford, and UC Berkeley, as well as Washington's National Cathedral. Her books, essays, and reviews have appeared in numerous publications, and it is my pleasure to welcome Nora Gallagher to this program to talk about her new work, Moonlight Sonata at the Mayo Clinic. It's just out from Knopf. Nora Gallagher, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Jeff.
Delight to have you here. Back in 2009, you were going through a relatively routine doctor's visit, and all of a sudden, your world changed. Tell us what happened.
I noticed a blur at the edge of my right eye as I was just building a fire at home, perfectly normal circumstances. So I went to my ophthalmologist, and he told me after a lengthy examination that I had an inflamed optic nerve and that I would need intravenous steroids, a phrase I had never heard. And so I walked from his office to the emergency room on, you know, fairly normal neighborhood streets, and there were doctors walking briskly and a woman talking on her cell phone and two kids on skateboards. And right in the middle of that, I felt as if a glass wall had fallen between me and them. It was a very specific feeling. I realized that they were oblivious in some way to the health of their bodies, as I had been not hours before, and going about their businesses purposefully. I was suddenly not in that world anymore. And that became the focus of the book over time, that I was living in a different country.
And it is so interesting that in a time in which we are so focused on our health and wellness and our bodies, that in fact it really is only the reverse of that. It is illness, it is sickness that really changes our world.
Yes, I think, you know, Susan Sontag, who I looked at extensively when I was working on this book, said something about how a great phrase, it's the night side of life. And it's interesting to me that we ignore it so completely. One of the things I realized over time was that as my illness went on and the doctors couldn't figure out what it was, I had people giving me advice. And again, I have done this myself. You know, have you tried this, or why aren't you doing that, or maybe you should? And I suddenly realized that it wasn't doing me any good. It was, in fact, making me more exhausted than I was already. And I finally began to see that this wall that I had thought was more or less my construction, the feeling of being in a separate country because I was so suddenly sick with something more than a cold or the flu, I realized that it was also their construction, however unconsciously, that they wanted to keep a distance from me. And I think this is almost a form of human nature, that we desire to keep a distance from someone who has suffered a calamity, be it illness or the death of someone or the loss of a job. Someone just brought that up in an interview I did in New York, that can put you in a separate country. And people don't want to know about that place. We want to keep it away. And the very simple reason for that is because we fear that it will happen to us.
Right, because there is this sense of almost contagion, because we are so infused with this sense of positive speak, that somehow if we just have a positive attitude, it will change everything or make everything go away.
Right. And I think that's really true. There was a woman who actually said to me, as she left a waiting room, think positively. And I wanted to say to her, you know, I can barely think at all. But yes, I think that's true. I think there's a very strong feeling of cause and effect. It must be something you did. There's a great line in one of the books I read or listened to while I was really very sick was Tolstoy's The Death of Ivan Ilyich. And there's a great scene where one of his friends comes to view the body in the living room, which is pretty close to the opening of the novella. And he looks at Ivan Ilyich's body and he looks at his watch because he really wants to get to his club to play cards. And he thinks to himself, he must have done something terribly wrong to have died. And I think that's really deeply in our hearts. That there's cause and effect, and it must be something someone did, and therefore it's not going to happen to you.
And it has such a profound effect on how people deal with illness when they have serious illness. I recently had the example of two people that dealt with really serious illness in two very different ways. One had cancer and talked about it all the time, and every treatment, every bit of it was on Facebook and public and everything. And another person that had an illness for a long time and ultimately passed away, nobody knew anything about it. They said they had back problems, they kept it a secret, except from a few very, very, very close friends, and never said a word.
Yeah. I think that the way different people deal with, you know, with very difficult illnesses it varies dramatically. And I really, one of the things I've been careful to do is be careful about giving any other patients advice. So many people give a patient advice, as I said before, that the way that one deals with one's own illness is completely up, you know, completely up to you. I understand both persons of why they took different courses. But I think one of the things I could say is that for those who are healthy, who I know many people with me, for example, were trying pretty hard to try to figure out what to say to me. And I think that's a commonplace problem. We don't know how to talk to someone who's sick. And a lot of people have been asking me various questions and answers what I would say to that. And my strongest feeling is not sort of a rote response. But if you can have the sense that this will happen to you, I mean, you will get sick eventually, you will die, this is true. And if you can let some of that in, if you can let some of the information, for want of a better word, in that this will happen to you and that this person is suffering, and just let the suffering in. One of my friends had a wonderful metaphor for that. You just hold the suffering as if you were holding a bird in your hands, rather than try to come up with advice or thinking positively or getting them out of this place. Just meet the suffering. And that's actually harder than one can imagine. But I've been noticing that since I got sick and since I wrote this book, that people who are in suffering much more than I am with, you know, stage 4 cancer or something else, that it's easier for me to actually be with them than it was before I got sick.
The overriding question becomes, how does the way in which you choose to interact with everybody else, be it privately, be it publicly, whatever the manner is, the way in which that impacts your own state of mind, your own treatment, and the way you approach your own illness?
Yes, I really found that the people who helped me the most, apart from the Mayo Clinic, which of course is in the title and where I went, where they finally diagnosed what I had, the people who helped me the most were the people who had something, some disaster happen to them. And they treated this as a reality, just kind of part of life, which of course it is. A woman with cancer brought me tea and left it on my porch with a little note, reminding me that when she was going through chemotherapy, I helped to shave her head. She just met me at the door one day when I was bringing her dinner and said, "You're going to have to come in here and shave my head." And I thought, well, never done that before. It's just, you know, there was a very kind of matter-of-factness about it, which really helped me. I needed to have this illness and my sudden descent into another world treated as if it were part of life, not a completely isolated, separate event that I had caused. And I think that, you know, that was the most helpful to me. Again, at the Mayo Clinic, what they do is they do their level best to treat patients as if they were human beings. No one was ever rude to me. No one ever gave me a vague answer. They are always specific in their replies and in their instructions. And the doctors are both funny and knowledgeable, which is a great combination.
Of course, it was all the more complicated in your case for so long because there was never a clear diagnosis, because it was so complicated to figure out what was wrong.
Yes, it was. And I think that's one of the reasons that I both advise people to go to specialists and advise them not to go to specialists. It's a complex thing. But I think if you go to one of the great research centers like Mayo, or, you know, I'm sure there are others that are great, I just haven't had the experience of them. They've seen a lot of cases. There are 1,000 people come through the doors of that clinic every day. So in my case, when I got to the right section of Mayo, they looked at my CAT scans and they knew exactly what I had because they'd seen other cases. Out here in California, they simply hadn't seen, they just didn't quite know how to narrow it down.
Of course, that's the other part of this that is another world. Not only dealing with illness, the way it changes your life, the relationships we've been talking about, but simply navigating with and dealing with the healthcare system such as it is.
Yeah, you really do find out. I mean, I know that many people have written about this, and my book touches on this area. It's not really an explication of the medical system, but it is frightening. One of the really disturbing parts of it are that doctors really do not talk to each other. They simply do not talk to each other. And that leaves you without the kind of brainstorming or creativity that's required to solve a problem. Whereas at Mayo, of course, they have a team approach. So at least they're all looking at the same results and tests and thinking about it as a team. One of my doctors here just explained to me, you know, we are entrepreneurs. That's what we do, and that's what we're trained to be, and we don't know how to work as a team.
The other aspect is that in the healthcare system today, you have to be, I mean, we hear this repeatedly, and certainly it always proves to be true, you have to be your own advocate. That's very difficult to do when you're suffering from a debilitating illness or an illness that frightens you.
Yes, it's really difficult. And I know that when people give you that advice, again, to say, you know, you've got to persist, you must take care of yourself and be your own advocate, you actually cannot do that alone. I think it's important for patients to not try to rise to that level, because you simply don't have the energy. Besides, you're overwhelmed with, you know, medical bills, sorting out what's what, insurance. I mean, I know one of the young woman who blogs for the New York Times regarding her cancer said that her mother had to quit her job in order to deal with the medical system. So it's not a small task. I found that my husband and my internist were both completely supportive of my persistence in finding out what had caused this problem so that it wouldn't happen again. And if without them, I could not have done it.
Which begs the question that I think people ask repeatedly when they've gotten to the other end of an illness: what if I hadn't? What if I didn't have that doctor? If I didn't have that husband? If I didn't act as my own advocate where I could? If any of those things had been different, the degree to which the outcome might be so profoundly different.
Oh, profoundly. I mean, if I hadn't had the network of people, I'm a journalist, or was trained as a journalist, and so I know that it's possible to find someone or something, that it's not an impossible task. If I hadn't had that training, if I hadn't had the help I had, if I hadn't known the people I do, there's an endless chain of that. And it is frightening, and I see why people completely give up.
Talk a little bit about the Mayo Clinic. What is it that brought you there? How did you finally come there after all the other efforts at diagnosis?
We simply didn't have a diagnosis after at least a year, and in my case, that affects medication. They were treating me with steroids, a mixture of steroids and a steroid-sparing drug called methotrexate. But if you don't know what you have, you can't figure out how to juggle the medications. And they were not successfully bringing me down off of very high doses of prednisone, which has not very good side effects over the long haul. It's a great drug in the first stages of inflammation. So my internist said to me, why don't we try the Mayo Clinic? I don't know how the clinic decides whether to see a patient or not. I think it's a complex decision on their part because so many people want to get into the clinic. In my case, my two doctors wrote letters describing my case, and they decided to take me as a patient. It is a phenomenal place. Just structurally, you're in a town where there are nothing else is going on except Mayo. So you drive into Rochester, Minnesota, and there are two huge buildings in the downtown area with those, you know, logo shield, pretty obvious Mayo Clinic signs. One of the main buildings where I spend a lot of time has a lobby that's probably three stories high. And it's made to allow so many thousands of people to come in the door without feeling crowded. And one of the sweetest things, and what gives the book the title, is that they have a grand piano in that lobby, with a very small Minnesotan sign that says, anyone can play this piano as long as you think people will enjoy it.
Once you had what you thought was a diagnosis, talk about the way that changed your attitude, your feelings, and how you approached being ill.
It's amazing what happens when you actually have a word that you can say, this is what I have. I've had several other friends comment on this after reading the book who've had difficult to diagnose illnesses. You keep thinking, oh, well, we're sort of on the right course. We kind of know what we're doing. The doctors kept saying, well, we know we're dealing with an autoimmune disorder. We know what drugs are available. But when I had all of the fretting in my mind stopped, the concern, what if this is this? What if it's that? Could it be something else? That all stopped. I knew what I had. It wasn't pretty, but it wasn't, it had a name. And it also focused my doctors. I noticed how much more focused they were. They too had a name. They knew who were the researchers in the field. They knew what papers to read. They knew who to talk to. They knew who to send me to. All of that dramatically changed the focus of how to take care of me.
It's interesting how in those situations the mind plays tricks on you before you have that word, before you have that diagnosis, that your mind goes to so many places that it shouldn't. And it's made worse usually by the fact that you're weakened by whatever the medication might be.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that came out of this for me was that the first night that I had realized something, that doctors had told me I had this inflamed nerve, I asked my pastor at my local Episcopal church, you know, what do I do now? And I realized that I didn't have any idea how to deal with this kind of situation. I didn't know how to quote pray unquote or anything else. And he said, he was very polite. He said, not that I've ever had to deal with this kind of situation, but one of the things I say to myself when I'm under a lot of stress is, what is real now? And that served me. for the next 3 years, if you can slowly train the mind to ask yourself, well, what's real now? What's going on in the moment? The whole business of meditation had seemed to me to be a great thing for other people and something I would never be able to do. But I've actually been quite sincere in my practice because I had to be. And I realized that the present actually has, this is such a generic word, it's not, doesn't sound very huge or revealing or anything else, but it has information in it, that every moment of time has its own information, and that if you're paying attention to that and not to the future, you really can get to the point where you're in what is real now.
Talk a little bit about what it is that you were finally diagnosed with.
I was diagnosed with a not so uncommon autoimmune disorder called sarcoidosis. It's a disease that always affects the lungs and often affects the eyes. It has actually, one of the leading specialists in this area told me that it's actually the third cause of inflammation in the optic nerve, which, again, doctors on the West Coast don't know as much about it. It's a very common disease, or not that common, but it's more common in the Midwest and in the Southeast. It's evenly distributed worldwide. They think that there is some environmental cause, which they don't say about all immune disorders, but they're pretty sure of that because of the lung involvement. And I heartily recommend finding people who are really at the top of the research chain on this particular disease, because the medication combination is quite tricky, and they're doing a lot of research on the front lines.
Were you to have another complex illness at some point in your life, how would you approach it differently?
That's a really good way to put it, Jeff, and no one has asked me that question. I would skip a lot of steps. I think one of the things we automatically do is, first, we rely on our local doctors because, of course, we have a trusted relationship with them. Next, we jump to specialists, and the arena of specialists, I think, is important for people to understand. They think, oh, well, this would be the person that will solve the problem. In fact, specialists do a lot of research, and some of them are very, of course, very useful, but mainly they do almost no follow-up, so they don't actually see patients. So that if you don't have an immediately diagnosable illness when you first see one of these specialists, you don't get anywhere. So I would not waste a lot of money and time on that particular arena of specialists, especially in teaching hospitals, where you mainly learn as a patient that they are there to teach their students first, and you're a kind of specimen rather than a patient. I would, of course, having learned this, I would go back to the Mayo Clinic almost immediately if I had anything complex, or I would go to one of the great, you know, other great hospitals or clinics, because I would know that they had a team of doctors, probably cutting-edge research, and finally the best machines. It is kind of frightening to discover that it's really important to have that latest MRI machine or the best blood lab, because the results can differ profoundly.
Of course, the other issue that comes into play in all of this is having the appropriate insurance for it all.
Yes. Yes, I mean, I thought one of the moments in the book, I describe being in Union Station in it's a train station in Los Angeles. I took the train a lot down to LA to talk to specialists, and I looked around me at everyone in this big station, and I saw a man who had clearly fallen off the edge of the world. He was sorting through trash bins. He was very elderly. He was clearly homeless. And then I looked around at everybody else in the station, and I hated them. I really hated them for being healthy, for walking around. And he and I had dropped off the face of the earth. Not that I was him. And the difference between us was exactly that. I had health insurance, and I had a job, and I had a husband, and he clearly had none of those things. So if I know that there are people who probably have my disease who are not being treated for it because they can't afford it.
Nora Gallagher, her book is Moonlight Sonata at the Mayo Clinic. Nora, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.